All right, so no slideshow today. I just want to explain what we're doing for the lab part. But this experiment is the most complex of all the ones in the semester. This is when it's, like I said, it's going to pay off if you can follow instructions. If not, it's going to take you a long time to do this, or maybe you won't even be able to do it right. I don't want that to happen. I want you to get good results. But anyway, what's the name of the thing we're doing today?
Biofuel enzyme assay.
Right, the biofuel enzyme assay. And what is an assay?
An assay.
And not an essay.
Oh.
Assay with two A's. That's two A's. So if you cut out letters from the newspaper... You'd need two A's to spell assay. It's A-S-S-A. Why? Anyway, what is it? An assay is just a test of some sort. A test to evaluate something. And in this case, we're going to evaluate how well a certain enzyme works. More about that in a minute, but... What is a biofuel? Well, it's a fuel that an organism makes. Humans are involved, but they don't actually directly make the fuel. It's not our cells that make the fuel. It's some other organism. Yeah, biofuels are one way to produce alternative energy sources. Compared to petroleum, for instance. And what is the bad thing about petroleum? Pollution is a problem, but it's not nearly as big a problem as something else. Non-renewable is not a problem either, because the damage that is going to be done by using up what still is here is going to make the problem of running out of oil seem like nothing. No, it's not toxic. Environment's a pretty vague answer. Oh, no, that's also not the problem. I mean, those are problems too. But the huge problem that you should be hearing about in the news, because it's the biggest problem that humans have ever faced, probably, is global warming. Global warming, though, is caused by what? Not by pollution. The greenhouse effect is what causes it, but what causes the greenhouse effect? No, not the ozone layer. Well, it's not the fuels that cause it.
It's the CO2.
Right, carbon dioxide. That's the correct answer. Carbon dioxide, which is not toxic. Carbon dioxide has always been a component of the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is what plants use that take in carbon dioxide and make sugar out of it, which feeds the world. Not only feeds those plants, it feeds us too. So it's not pollution that causes the global warming. It's the fact that carbon dioxide molecules are transparent to the light energy that comes in from the sun. They let that in, just like a greenhouse lets the sunlight in. But the heat that builds up gets beamed back as a different wavelength of light. It's infrared light. And that gets blocked by the CO2. So it lets heat in, but it doesn't let it out. And therefore, the more CO2 that's in the environment or in the atmosphere, the more global warming is going to become a problem. And so anyway, burning petroleum turns that fuel, which has several different carbons in it, each molecule, burning that fuel turns it into carbon dioxide and water. That's what a combustion reaction does. And so burning fossil fuels is exponentially increasing the carbon dioxide, which has been stable for hundreds of thousands of years. All right, now it's just peaking. So one way to deal with this is use of biofuels. And biofuels, like ethanol, for instance, which is the same kind of alcohol that's in alcoholic beverages, it can be used as a fuel, and it's a component of gasoline already. Burning it does the same thing. If you burn alcohol, you also make carbon dioxide, just like if you burn gasoline. But biofuels are considered to be carbon neutral because even though they release carbon dioxide, producing them to begin with, which requires the plants undergoing photosynthesis, takes carbon dioxide out. So the amount that you release is the same as the amount that you take out of the atmosphere to produce the fuel to begin with. And therefore, they're considered to be carbon neutral. All right, now, you can get ethanol from a lot of different sources. Ethanol is produced during what process that we talked about? Fermentation, good. And all you need to do is provide the cells that are doing the fermenting with sugar. Because remember, fermentation and glycolysis go hand in hand. The cell is not doing the fermenting for the goal of making the alcohol. It's doing that fermentation just so that glycolysis can continue. Glycolysis is what gives it energy. So sugars are the fuels that these cells use during fermentation, and the end result is alcohol. So if we get, the idea here is if we get plants to produce sugars for us and then get cells to ferment those sugars, we can have ethanol to use as a fuel source. Well, you can do that, for instance, by using corn. You know, we produce a lot of corn in this country, not all of which gets eaten. A big fraction of that corn is made just to ferment the corn to produce ethanol that's put into gasoline. Well, that's not as good an idea. If the goal is to make ethanol, it would be better to use something that is not also a food source, right? So that you're not using food. And for instance, the leftover parts of corn plants, after you harvest the corn for food, all of that leftover stuff in the field is valuable stuff in terms of the ability to make ethanol. All that stuff is cellulose. What is cellulose? Yes, it is a sugar, but what kind specifically? No. Sugars are what kind of molecules? Well, not all sugars are, but all sugars are carbohydrates, right? And remember, there are big carbohydrates, which are macromolecules, and there are small carbohydrates. What are the small carbohydrates called in general? Simple sugars are called what? Well, you gave me the name of complex sugars, the big ones. Polysaccharides are big ones. What are the small ones? Monosaccharides. Exactly. Polysaccharides are made by stringing together a bunch of monosaccharides. All right? Cellulose is a polysaccharide that plants make. And so all that, the corn leaves and all the unused stuff as far as food is concerned, that's almost all cellulose. But if you look at a cellulose molecule at the molecular level, it really is just pure glucose. Glucose is a monosaccharide. It's the most important fuel for all cells, right? So if you have a cell that undergoes fermentation to produce ethanol for you, it uses glucose as the fuel. Cellulose is chock full of glucose. But it's not glucose molecules occurring individually. They're not on their own. They're linked together into these huge molecules called cellulose. And so the fermenting cell can't use cellulose. It has to use glucose. Therefore, the trick is to break cellulose down into individual glucose molecules. All right. Once you're at that point, then this stuff that's worthless as far as food for us is concerned can be used to make ethanol for a biofuel. Well, if you break cellulose down to the point where you have chunks, each of which are just two glucoses still held together, then those two glucose pieces are called cellobios. So a single cellobios molecule is two glucose molecules hooked together. It's an example of a disaccharide because it's two monosaccharides. All right? And that's why today we're going to be evaluating how well an enzyme called cellobiase is able to work. Cellobiase is named for the fact that it breaks cellobios into the two pieces it's made out of. It breaks it down into individual glucose molecules. Now, what do we call, in general, the thing that binds to an enzyme, the thing that an enzyme works on? What do we call that? Oh. Does anyone know? Well, I do. But does any of you? An enzyme works by binding to a substrate. So each enzyme has a certain substrate that it fits with and therefore works on. All right, the substrate is the reactant in the reaction. The enzyme is not a reactant, right? Enzymes are catalysts, so they don't get turned into a product. Substrate does, though.
You want me to calibrate?
They just need to be zeroed. No, that's not necessary at all. You can do that if you want, yeah, because I might not be able to figure it out quickly. Okay, you better do it then. So, in this reaction, there's reactant and product, right? What's the reactant? And what is the substrate? Specifically, what is it? Reactant and substrate are the same thing in this reaction, but what actually is it? No, that's a product. Well, actually, it's not a product of this reaction. It's not even involved in this reaction. Well, I already told you what the substrate is. You just need to repeat it to me. Yes, cellobios. So what is the reaction? The reaction takes cellobios and does what? Into what? Two glucose molecules, exactly. So those are the products, glucose. And the thing that helps that out, the enzyme that catalyzes that reaction, is cellobiase. Okay? Now, if you were to rate how well that enzyme is working, that's really just the same question as how quickly does this enzyme turn a certain amount of cellobiose into glucose? So enzymes work well when the substrate, which is the reactant, disappears. In which case the product starts accumulating, right? So there's really two different ways that you could rate or assess how well an enzyme's working. You could measure how quickly the reactant is disappearing, which in this case would be cellobiose, or you could measure how quickly the product is accumulating, which in this case is glucose. Now this is happening in solution, in tubes, in that have the aqueous solution containing these molecules in it. So really, determining how fast substrate disappears or determining how quickly product appears is going to require measuring concentrations of these things, right? Because they're in solution. So how did we already determine concentrations of solutions that we knew the identity of? We knew what kind of solute was there. We just didn't know how much. How did we do it before? I know at least one of you was here that day. We haven't had any empty classes yet.
Can you repeat the question?
How did we determine the concentration of solute in solution before?
The absorbency of light to the spectrophotometer.
Exactly. We determined it spectrophotometrically. We used a spectrophotometer to determine how much of that stuff was in the solution we had that we were interested in. Well, that's in general how you can determine a concentration, spectrophotometrically. Yeah, exactly. When we put them in the cuvettes, put the cuvettes in the spectrophotometer, shone light through them, and then you had a readout of the absorbance. That absorbance is an indication of how strong the solution is, how concentrated it is. All right. So if you're talking about an enzyme assay, you can either use spectrophotometry to determine how quickly the substrate is disappearing, or use a spectrophotometer to measure how quickly the product is appearing. Either one will give you the same answer, which is how well the enzyme is working, right? But that only works if either the or if whatever you're looking for with the spectrophotometer actually absorbs light. Not all things absorb light, right? So in this reaction, in the real reaction that we're interested in using for the energy to produce the ethanol, you have cellobiose being broken down into glucose. So cellobiose is the substrate. Glucose is the product. The problem with spectrophotometry, in this case, is that cellobiose is invisible to the light, so you can't measure the disappearance of the substrate. And glucose is also invisible to the light, so you can't use spectrophotometry to measure the accumulation of the product either. All right, so it seems like spectrophotometry would be impossible to rate the effectiveness of this particular enzyme, except that there's a workaround for this problem. The normal substrate of cellobiase is, of course, what it's named for, cellobiose. But if instead you use a different substrate, because enzymes can have more than one kind of substrate they can work on, if they're similarly enough shaped, then if you can do that and produce something that can be seen by the spectrophotometer, then you can use spectrophotometry to measure the effectiveness of the enzyme. What is that molecule that we use in this? Anyone know? You mentioned, what did you mention?
Nitrophenoglucopyranose.
Right, which is abbreviated what?
No.
Oh, it doesn't give you the abbreviation?
It writes it out a bunch of times.
Okay. But nitrophenol, whoops. Nitrophenol beta pyranoside, galactopyranoside, right?
Glucopyranoside.
Okay. That is a molecule that's very similar to cellobiose. Cellobiose, the real stuff that we're interested in, is two glucoses stuck together, right? Nitrophenyl beta glucopyranoside is two molecules stuck together as well, but it's not two glucoses. It's one glucose and one, or it's P nitrophenyl phenol, isn't it? Yeah, not O. There's two different kinds. P nitrophenol and glucose attached to each other make nitrophenyl beta glucopyranoside. All right? And since that is shaped enough like cellobiose, a cellobiase enzyme will recognize nitrophenyl beta glucopyranoside as a substrate. And it will break it into the two pieces it's made out of, just like it breaks cellobiose apart. Okay? But when it breaks the nitrophenyl beta glucopyranoside apart, the two pieces that are made are not two glucoses. It's one glucose and one P-nitrophenol. Now, I've already told you that glucose is invisible to the spectrophotometer, so that's not going to be detectable. But P-nitrophenol is detectable because P-nitrophenol does absorb light, which is why it appears yellowish to us. All right, so the better the enzyme is working, the more P-nitrophenol is produced, and therefore the more and more yellow that solution will become. Well, you can use a spectrophotometer to give you an actual number of how yellow it is, basically. Right? The higher the absorbance that you measure at 410 nanometers, which is why we have to set these to 410, that's the ideal wavelength for this stuff to absorb the light well. The greater that absorbance is, that means the more nitrophenol is present, which means the enzyme has done its job better, right? Because this stuff comes from breaking the substrate apart, which is what the enzyme's job is to do.
So, since you said that glucose wasn't visible...
Yeah, it doesn't absorb light in the visible range for the spectrophotometer.
Yeah, so... So the nitrophenol is visible since it turns yellow?
Yeah.
Does that mean that every yellow count, that would mean the same amount of glucose found would be the same?
Yes. Yes.
Right.
It not only means that, but in a sense that doesn't matter. It's true, but it just doesn't really matter because what we really care about, the question we're asking is how well does this enzyme work? So even if there were no glucose in the stuff that it's breaking apart, it's still working as an enzyme if it breaks something apart. So we're just giving it a different substrate to break apart compared to what we would normally be using it for in this method of making ethanol for fuel. But we give it this different substrate just so that we can detect the product that it forms. Because the real product, which would be pure glucose, is undetectable. All right, everyone understand that part so far? So, by the way, we're not doing part three of this. We're doing, there's three parts, but we're only doing the first two. And also I should tell you that on part one, Alan did make the standards ahead of time, so you can skip right to four. But anyway, that's background information as to what we're doing in the experiment. We're using a spectrophotometer to measure, to get an indication of how well the enzyme works, to see whether it's feasible to put this onto an industrial scale operation to make a lot of ethanol for biofuel purposes. But absorbance, which is what you directly read with the spectrophotometer, is not concentration, right? It's not concentration, it's not amount of solute. It's just an absorbance. So to actually get the amount of the stuff that's produced, or the concentration of it, you need to convert that absorbance reading into number of moles, or number of millimoles. All right? And to do that requires using a standard curve. Now, a standard curve is a graph, but it's a special graph that you produce using solutions called standards. And you have that's what has been made for you today. There are, what, five standards? Yeah, S1 through S5 are the five standards. The reason these are called standard solutions, or standards, is that we make them. We know exactly how much of the solute is in those. In this case, the solute is what? What solute are we trying to measure?
Nitrophenol.
Yes, the p-nitrophenol. The stuff that, the only stuff involved today that is visible to the spectrophotometer. That's the solute we care about, right? So that's the stuff that makes it yellow. And therefore, your standards should each be a different yellowness. But they're called standard solutions because we know going into it what the actual amount in each solution is, since we make them up. And then we measure them, we put them in the spectrophotometer to measure the absorbance. Since we know the number of millimoles, and we can measure the absorbance, that the graph that results, which is the standard curve, gives us a way to relate absorbance to millimoles of solute. All right. So, if you were to make a graph after you make your standards, what is going to be on the vertical axis of your standard curve? Right, which is what? What are you actually measuring?
Absorbance.
Right. And what's the thing you're adjusting in making the standard curve? No. Right. The number of millimoles, or the concentration of, in millimolar, of your standards. So each standard has a different concentration, right? That's what you know going into it. So you have one that is zero, has none of the p-nitrophenol in it at all, right? But then you'll also, your other standards will have some amount. It gets higher and higher. So you have values here that you're measuring the absorbance of, and that should make a graph. The absorbance goes up as you add more and more of the stuff in your standard solutions, right? And you can fit a line to those data, line of best fit. Okay? And what is the standard equation for a line? Or not the standard equation, the slope-intercept form of a...
Y
equals MX plus B, right. Now what is B? The y-intercept, which means the value of y where the line crosses the y-axis. Okay? Now in this case, no matter where these points are, the fitted line should be forced to go through this point. Because this is not really a measurement. This is the standard that you use to zero the instrument, right? So you're defining this as zero. And therefore, it is a true point. It doesn't have any error in it. All these other measurements might have some error in them. So when you fit this line, you force it to go through 0, 0, and you get it as close as possible to the other ones. But that means that the value of B is what? 0. In other words, you can just eliminate it from the equation, and it just boils down to Y equals MX. M is the slope, which the computer, if you use a computer to figure this out, It'll spit out what M is. It'll give you a value of M. But since you're on this particular graph in which you've plotted absorbance versus concentration, let me just write this as concentration. Y equals MX is really just another way of saying that absorbance, which is what Y is, equals M, whatever that value is that the computer gives you, times the concentration. Right? Now that's the standard curve. The whole reason you go about doing this is because you want to use this standard curve later to figure out what the concentration is of the solution that you're running in the experiment. Right? You're trying to be able to ask the question, answer the question, how well is the enzyme working? You need to know how much p-nitrophenol built up in your reaction vessel. In other words, you need to know the concentration of p-nitrophenol. But the only thing that you can get directly from the spectrophotometer is the absorbance. So you need to be able to convert that absorbance into a concentration. All right? Setting up the standard curve gives you this equation with M as a number. Now, if you solve this equation for concentration, what do you get? What does it mean to solve it for concentration? What does it mean to solve an algebraic equation? It means get concentration by itself on the left side of the equation, right? So concentration equals what? Well, what is Y? Absorbance divided by M. Okay? You see now how this standard curve is acting like a measuring stick, basically? Because after you know what this M is, you can put in a solution that you don't know the concentration of, get an absorbance, plug that absorbance in here, divide it by the M that the computer spits out when it fits that line, and out pops concentration. Right? So the standard curve lets you convert an absorbance value into a concentration value. And therefore, you can tell how much actual product is formed in a given amount of time by that enzyme. In other words, you can now assess how well that enzyme is working. Now, what part of that doesn't make sense?
So the spectrophotometer will give us M?
No. Spectrophotometer can only give you absorbances. Fitting the standard curve, fitting the line to this graph, and computing the slope is what gives you M. And you can do that by hand, right? You can hand graph something and calculate. Right. The equation for M itself is the change in Y divided by the change in X, which is often called rise over run, right? The rise, you can compute this for any two points on any line. If you have a line, just choose any two points. The rise is how much you have to move vertically, starting at one point, just moving vertically to get to the other point is a two-step process, right? You have to go up or down, and then you have to go right or left. So this is delta Y. Delta means change in. So that's the change in Y. The run is delta X. So for instance, if this were the point 1.3, 2.4, okay, and this one were 3.7 and 5.6, those are ordered pairs, right? X and Y for each point. Then you would compute that as the second Y minus the first Y over the second X minus the first X. which would be, in this case, if we call this the second point and this one the first one, it will be 5.6 minus 2.4. See that? The two y's. Divided by 3.7 minus 1.3, which would be 3.2 divided by 2.4. Right? Which you could, whatever that is, put that as a single number. That's how you would do it by hand. Well, Excel, if you use Excel to do your graphing, which you will, the computer will figure that out. It'll spit out the M for you. Once you have the M, then all you have to do for solutions that you don't know the concentration of, but you know it's the same stuff, p-nitrophenol, you just put it in the spectrophotometer, get an absorbance, divide that absorbance by the M, and you have the concentration. That's what the standard curve is for. All right? Absorbance by itself doesn't tell you anything. You have to convert that into what you really care about, which is the concentration of that stuff. Now, probably several of you have never used Excel to do this. So we'll talk about how that's done next time. But today you want to get good data so that we can analyze them next time. All right? Doing that is really going to require you to know what the hell you're doing. Now, you should have already read this just because you're always supposed to read it anyway. But there's even a special note in here today that says, read and understand the following steps before proceeding. It's not going to work if you read one step at a time and then do that step and then try to read the next step. Because you have to work in a certain amount of time. This is a timed procedure. Right? This is the way you're going to mess it up if you don't follow instructions. So, completely understand what you're going to do with which tubes, in what order, before you actually start doing it. Okay? Now, what we have here is, we have different kinds of solutions, but notice that one of them is called a stop solution. And at step 6, you put 500 microliters of stop solution into each of your labeled cuvettes. Well, why do you suppose that stuff is called stop solution?
Stop the reaction.
Exactly. We want to stop the reaction. And the way that's done is with a drastic change in pH. So the stop solution is at a completely wrong pH for that enzyme to work. Therefore, when you put the solution into the stop solution, that drastic pH change will cause that enzyme to be destroyed, basically, which means it, however much substrate it has converted into product by that time, that's all it's going to do. It's going to stop that reaction. Well, you have to stop these reactions at the appropriate time, which is why you need to know what the hell you're doing in each of these steps. Otherwise, it's going to be even more of a pain in the ass when you try to analyze these results next time. So follow what, pay attention to what you're doing, get good results, and maybe we can make some sense of it next time. Okay? But like I said, the standards have already been made to you. I'll hand them out in a second. So you can skip right to 4. And we're completely skipping part 3. So you have 3 pages of stuff you need to carefully do today. All right, let me give you your stuff.